This is CliffCentral.com. Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on CliffCentral.com.
Well, good morning, folks. It's another Monday morning, and we have a semi-full studio, and I hope you all had a really good weekend. How's it going, Wendile?
Hi, George, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I had a really good weekend. It was pretty relaxed. I just spent some time with the family, so I can't really complain.
You can't really complain. No. It's always a good thing to spend time with the family.
Yeah.
Lawrence?
Running around in the bush in Lichtenburg.
Oh.
Yeah, I went to the Lichtenburg 400 South African cross country rally championship thing because Fernando Alonso was there and I got to meet the man.
Okay. Did you get a selfie with him?
No, I did not.
Oh, no.
We only had 30 seconds each, so I just said, welcome to South Africa, hope you enjoy and good luck for the race. And he promptly rolled the car and hit a guinea fowl.
Well, in South Africa, that's what we do, hit guinea fowls. Martin?
How's it, George?
Right on you.
Yeah.
Good. How's your weekend?
Pretty relaxing. Had a family get together on Saturday, and yesterday I spent spring cleaning.
Ah, spring cleaning.
Yeah.
It's always a good thing to declutter.
Mm. Well, there's that, and there's also the fact that I have a pit bull puppy who tends to destroy everything. So once in a while, you have to clear up whatever she destroyed over the last couple of days.
Okay.
Namely, your shoes.
No. I keep my bedroom door closed when I'm not there.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that was a good weekend. I had a very busy weekend myself. And, you know, let's get straight into it. And the first thing in the news this morning is electric car sales fall for the very first time.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
What are you oh, dearing about? I thought you'd be cheering.
Have you ever heard of sarcasm?
Was that sarcasm?
Sarcasm. The distance between what you and understanding what you talk. Actually, I mean.
Never mind. Sarcasm.
All right. So electric car sales fall for the very first time, and the global electric car sales fell for the first time in modern history. Now, I don't think this is a lack of demand. It's after China scaled back on purchase subsidies, highlighting the role that government assistance plays in driving electric car sales. Now, you know, the thing that is important here, and that plays into the next piece of news that we have, and that is, you know, the fact that governments need to help, and another piece of news is that government around the world, or should I say, electric car manufacturers around the world, are asking governments to try and help with the subsidies around making electric cars possible. And the thing I took out of all of this was governments put deadlines in place to meet emissions regulations and let's make the world a greener place. And then they sit back and do what?
Nothing.
Yeah,
very little. So now manufacturers are asking the government, please help, please reduce taxes, please, you know, do all this stuff. And then China goes and pulls this move.
Well, that leaves another question, unfortunately, which is the flip side of the coin. If electric cars need that level of subsidization from government, are they really viable to start off with?
Yeah, I'm not sure that link is quite apparent to me, because what do you mean viable?
What if they need that kind of government subsidization?
Well, it's only because of the cost, because it's new technology, right?
Yeah.
We're paying for the R&D now.
Yeah, we're paying for the R&D up front. So that's where the subsidy needs to come from, is these electric cars are expensive. They're not cheap. But they are a better technology. They are a faster technology. They are a greener technology. And the reason governments need to help is because we just, as consumers, don't have the wherewithal to spend more money on an electric car than what an ICE vehicle costs. And what would you do if you were a consumer and an electric car cost 20-30% more than an ICE vehicle? You'd go for the ICE vehicle, because another piece of research shows that the younger generations today don't really care. They're using the car functionally. They don't really care about the fanciness anymore.
Yeah, I don't think the story talks, like you said, to demand. I mean, if you it's happening anyways, right? So, like, with governments, they have to move on and subsidize electric vehicles anyways.
It's everybody like get your tinfoil hats, because Lawrence is about to talk. Oil. It comes down to oil.
You talk a lot anyway. So.
Yeah.
Okay, it goes down to oil. What about
it's
oil?
It's the world's reliance on oil and fuel. You take away oil and fuel, and then they've got nothing to tax you on anymore.
Oh, you think the government's slowness?
Yes.
So what is this? All like, let's all get green, let's all save the planet, let's all do this stuff.
But we're still going to collect a lot of money in taxes through the fuel.
But the consumer must just, you know,
suck behind. How would you tax electricity, though? How would the government sort of still get their money?
I reckon on a pay-per-use basis. In other words, as you fill in your log forms or your logbooks for your tax returns, you get taxed on the distance you've driven.
What is the CO2 tax on a new car now, by the way? Sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
That's a good question.
The CO2 tax on a car, on a big SUV, now all of a sudden they can't tax you on that because you're not making CO2. So they're out.
So they have to recover that some way.
So that's why they don't want to subsidize, because they're going to lose.
Okay, so just a coal power station probably makes the biggest amount of CO2 known to man. Okay. And do they get CO2 emissions taxes?
They should, if they don't.
So effectively, the car manufacturers have been charged this CO2 tax. When we move to electric, we won't have to pay the CO2 tax, so taxes come down. We're asking for subsidies to make the electric vehicle switch around the world. China's made this move and changed some regulations, which has slowed down global sales. So I think, to your point, Martin, the governments can still get their money. You just need to charge on a pay-per-use basis when it comes to electricity.
Yeah.
That's all. Mm. You know, they can get their money through electrical systems.
You see, at the moment, they generate a lot of revenue worldwide through fuel tax. And as soon as you switch over to electric, that falls away.
No, but it doesn't.
So they have to recover it somehow.
It doesn't.
And that's where something like a pay-per-use basis comes in. If you have an electric vehicle and you travel this kind of distance, that's how much you will be charged to have driven that car. Mm.
So I think the manufacturers are in the right ballpark in saying to governments, please come to the party. Help us to sell electric vehicles, because it's not only about the sales. It's about moving the countries and the world to a greener environment.
But now,
I think there are a lot of people out there that want an electric car. They're just not prepared to pay the
upfront cost.
Yeah.
Because it is more expensive.
Speaking of China, China has now basically completed a full year of passenger vehicle sales drops. Partly because of their cut down on government subsidies. With that coming to an end, a lot of dealerships and manufacturers actually sold off old stock. So the month of June, I think, saw a brief spike.
Mm.
But now, year on year, it's down. Basically down.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's a negative territory.
By about 10% compared to the previous year.
That's globally. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, it's monthly sales worldwide fell by 14% to 128,000 plug-in passenger electric cars. Mm. This happened, you know, in the last month of July. And like you say, in June, the spike occurred as a result of them seeing this coming and then selling off the units that they were on their floors. But nonetheless, I don't think there's a lack of demand. There's clearly demand. It's just governments need to help subsidize the car getting on the road. Get the taxes in another way. But Tesla still dominates global electric sales. Taking 20,000 units of sales in the month of July. And, BYD taking 16,000, BMW 9,000, and Bike 8,000, believe it or not.
Wow.
And then everyone else together 75,000, which is smaller than the small parts that I just mentioned. So Tesla seems to be leading the charge as a pure play electric manufacturer still.
I'd be interested to see what happens if Tesla comes to South Africa. If the demand and the sales increase in SA as well, because people love it, but can they afford it in South Africa is my question.
A Tesla Model 3 is what, $30,000-$35,000 US?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you put that into the context of what we pay for cars, it is slightly higher than the average 250, yeah. 350,000 rand car. You know, your GTIs are cheaper than a Tesla Model 3.
I'd go with the GTI.
You'd go with the GTI. It but it's an ICE car.
Electric GTI. Yeah. A GTI.
GTE.
So, closer to home, the top 50 selling vehicles in August 2019. So, the South African new vehicle market continued its decline with a 3.7% downward shift to the same month last year, which was August, and a total of 46,077 units sold. So, we continue the new car decline. But here's an interesting thing, and that is the light commercial vehicle segment increased by 2.9% year on year. The medium and heavy commercial vehicle segment increased by 14.9% and the 21.4% respectively, but passenger car sales took a beating at minus 8.2%. Does that tell you something about construction in the country?
Either that or people are selling off their daily drivers to buy
trucks
and yeah. cars,
multi-purpose.
No, the light commercial increased by 2.9%, but medium to heavy commercial increased by 15% and 21%, which is not your LCV.
No, business is doing well.
You know, I think there are pockets of excellence and pockets of
growth
in the country that, you know, and this for me speaks to manufacturing. And I mean, have you driven through Sandton and seen how many buildings they're building?
Unfortunately, yes.
It's happening all over the place. So anyway, on the export front, sales increased by 22% versus the same month last year, which was August. The lowering of interest rates by a 25 basis points added some relief from lower fuel prices during July and offered some reprieve from financially strained consumers. So I think all in all, new car vehicle sales are declining, but it doesn't mean that people aren't driving cars.
I just wonder how much of that 2.9% growth in light commercial vehicles was actually due to some major fleet contract coming through for the Nissan NP200.
Because
it went from nowhere on the sales charts to number two.
Yeah, but that's LCV, okay?
Yeah, that's LCV.
Yeah.
So that 2.9%.
That could be as a result of that fleet deal.
I think that plays a large role there.
Yeah. So the Nissan NP300, as Martin says.
200.
Sorry, NP200.
Yeah, there's a misprint here on this article.
Oh, okay. And Nissan NP200 moved out of the top 50 to jump all the way to second place.
Outselling the Ford Ranger by 6 units.
So let's get into that top list. The Toyota Hilux still tops the list at 3,565 vehicles sold. And then the Nissan NP200, supposed to be NP200, not NP300, 2,301. It's probably fall off next month again.
Yep.
And then the Ford Ranger, surprise, 2,295. The VW Polo Vivo, 2,252. VW Polo at 2,124. And the Toyota Hiace at 1,578, so on and so forth. But interesting to mention is the Toyota Fortuner sold only 811 units, the first of the batch at under 1,000 units. So I wonder what's happening to the Fortuner.
That's still a pretty strong sales performance if you look at its competitors.
Not historically,
which are far, far down.
Not historically.
Unfortunately, the Fortuner has a very large target on its back, and I think the consumers are also looking and they're going, I really do like the car, but do I really want to put myself at risk?
It's about hijackings.
Massive hijacking risk. Yeah. And, it's old. I think they're on to year three now since the last generation was released. We're due for a facelift next year, and then you might see a bit of a jump again, but...
So interesting to note, on this top 50, I do not see an electric car or a hybrid.
Nope.
So that kind of goes back to, you know, governments need to subsidize this shift if it's going to be effective. Because we've spoken a lot about the fact that there is a charging infrastructure for electric vehicles. I mean, you don't need a charging infrastructure for hybrids. Maybe the hybrid is the next logical choice for most South Africans, but we're not seeing the cars on the roads, and you can see that through the sales numbers. Although at Auto Trader we see demand, people are searching for electric vehicles that don't actually exist. So there is demand for electric vehicles.
Okay, last takeaway from this top 50 vehicles. It's how the mighty have fallen. Volkswagen Golf sitting way down at 322 units. And we know most of those are GTIs and Rs. And the Corolla, less than 200 units. Who else here remembers the time when the Toyota Corolla was South Africa's
vehicle? Yeah. It was like the Hilux. No, you're right. And then the 200,000th Polo rolled off the line at VW SA's Uitenhage plant. And VW SA has been producing various Polos for 23 years and has produced over 1 million vehicles for export. So VW's been exporter of the year 3 times so far. So we're not the only Polo lovers, looks like it. Nope. Looks like Polo is quite a popular car the world over.
Of the 200 new Polos that have now been manufactured since the beginning of 2018, 153,000, more than 153,000 were exported.
Wow.
So less than a quarter actually sold off here, and the rest are
all exported.
All exported.
But that's good for our country. It's good for our economy anyway. So not a bad thing. And well done to VW. I think the more we have those manufacturing plants operating in the country, the more our economy will fly. And then speaking about electric vehicles, it looks like the German manufacturers are spluttering, for lack of a better term. The end of the combustion engine era. Well, let's see what China does about that. Car buyers are more interested in data connectivity and horsepower than horsepower, threatening German spot at the top of the automotive pecking order. So what's interesting here is that are pure play manufacturers like Tesla getting it right, because they're playing into the hands of the new consumer?
Yes, I reckon so. I've actually been wondering about this German horsepower war for a while as well. I mean, when will it end and how will it end? And I think
it'll end with electric cars.
I think we're seeing the end of the internal combustion engine performance car. We are in the death throes of that era. And unfortunately, the Germans were caught flat-footed with this.
But it's not like they're sitting on their hands. Are way behind.
Flat feet sitting on their hands.
They are way behind the eight ball here. But they realized, wait a minute, we better actually start doing something. So you have manufacturers like Audi throwing everything they have, and I do mean everything, electric. The Frankfurt Motor Show that just happened last week, you saw almost every single car that was unveiled was some sort of hybrid or electric car. Almost no petrol engines that were
released. But is it coming to the party a little bit late?
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes. But they're not sitting around waiting for the end. They're saying, okay, well, let us now. And that is why we're starting to see so many of these joint ventures, companies joining forces to they're going to amalgamate their technologies and work on something together so they eventually do get something out so that they're not left standing at the altar,
So as a consequence of this new consumer and the interest in data connectivity rather than horsepower, I mean, let's be honest, an electric car comes standard with horsepower. There is no two fours about that. You don't buy an electric car and it's not powerful. It doesn't. Even the little i3 is powerful.
A little while.
I don't know. You see, I think
there's one standing downstairs in the parking lot. Myself and Martin were having a bit of a chat about it this morning. And I actually said, I want one. I want an i3.
Exactly.
Because it's weird and it's quirky and it has odd-sized tires on it.
It can now get to Joburg and back to Pretoria on a single charge.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know what I'm really excited for, though? And it's German, I think, is the ID3. I think that's going to be a huge game changer for the people who want to buy electric vehicles, especially in countries like South Africa.
Cheaper mobility.
Yeah.
I think you're right, but I don't think they'll trump the pure plays in the long run because they've got all of this legacy stuff. And to make that switch, I mean, we did it as a business. We went from print business to a digital business. Freaking hard to do. It's not easy. So you've got to now go from a traditional tooling and manufacturing and all that stuff. Now suddenly you've got to almost run two sets of production lines.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what Volkswagen's been doing. I mean, they have their new electric platform, MEB. Yeah. And for fans of the Beetle, yay, it's rear-engined again.
But that being said, you know, I was watching the World Rallycross over the weekend as well. They actually debuted the new race cars for next season.
Yeah.
There's going to be a whole other category called Project E, which is electric rallycross. So even motorsport is saying, you know, guys, we have to face facts. This is where the future is. And if we don't get on the bus now, you're going to be left standing in the rain.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there are, like I said, a lot of the guys, they are now only starting to catch up. But in the years to come, we are going to see the further decline of ICE engines. Sorry, Martin. And, you know, the steady replacement of those engines with electric vehicles. Well, it doesn't matter who's making them, whether they're pure play or legacy.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm saying the switch to from legacy to compete with the pure plays like Tesla is hard to do. And you can see that in the sales volumes. You can absolutely see it in the sales volumes. And you can also see it in the mere fact that the German car production has slumped to the lowest level since 2010.
Sure.
German car production has slumped to the lowest level since 2010. I mean, you tell me that those numbers don't tell the story. Tesla, number one sales of electric cars in the world. The German powerhouse slumped to the lowest levels of production since 2010. Now, just those two data points alone tell me that it's very, very difficult for an OEM to make the switch. Not saying that they're not gonna, but it's very difficult and very costly.
Well, there are other
factors. So governments still have to come to the party, right?
I think there are other factors at play here as well. Traditionally, if you wanted the latest tech in your car, you had to buy a premium brand because they were first with all.
But they're no longer the latest. You've got the latest tech.
And that's the thing.
I mean, all of the millennials are bantering towards the technology in the car rather than the horsepower.
So they're not looking, well, let's call it the Germans and the European manufacturers in general don't have that monopoly anymore because technology has become a lot more democratized. We'll get to that shortly as well when we talk about the Toyota connectivity thing.
Well, before we get there, let's do our Auto Talk segment, and that is with Lawrence and the Ford Mustang 5-liter.
I was a very, very happy motoring enthusiast last week. The Ford Mustang GT Fastback is just one of those vehicles that does something for your soul that there isn't another vehicle out there that can do what that car does. And it's not because it's better at driving or it has more power or anything. It's just it's a American muscle car. And the video that I made is out. It's on the site now. I actually had to cut it back because I had a lot to say about the previous generation that wasn't very good. The first generation Mustangs that arrived in South Africa were, to put it bluntly, quite crap. They were terrible.
Well, I drove one. It was uninspiring.
Yeah, terrible build quality, lackluster suspension. The engines were It was a meh car. And when you've got a meh car that's commanding prices in the 1 million rand mark, you know, you can sort of understand why, you know, the proper motoring purist went, we'll wait.
Yeah, I'm not going to do this.
I think basically what happened was Ford realized this. They nipped across to Europe and kidnapped some engineers from, like, BMW or Audi or something and brought them back to America and put them to work in Detroit because the new Mustang, my word, it's a completely different car. Yes, it looks the same, but the build quality is better. Just the whole package is this much. You know, you take a walk around the car and all the body lines line up now.
Whoa.
Yeah. You know, first generation, you know, you put a credit card on one side and you could put your thumb in on the other side. It was that bad.
It was really, really bad in the beginning.
So this new one, you know, they've done minimal cosmetic work on the exterior of the vehicle, so it still looks like the GT Fastback from the previous generation. But when you get inside the car, wow. Black leather, brushed aluminium, you know, it's really, really, really nice. It's like
Is it a Mustang, though?
Yes. But then what they've, you know, when then you start going a little bit deeper and you realize just how much tech they've shoehorned into the inside of this car. You now have things like lane keep assist, lane departure warning, pre-collision alert. There's adaptive cruise control. These are all things that no Mustang has ever had. You know, it has. Then you have things that you can set the tone of the exhaust for your everyday driving. So you have like fully open, raspy, full V8, all the way down to, it sounds like a sewing machine. You have the ability to set the exhaust on a timer so that when you leave in the morning, you don't wake up the neighbors. It's actually called the good neighbor function. It's amazing.
The good neighbor function.
That's what it's called in the manual. It's called the good neighbor function. So you can set so that if you leave at 6:30 in the morning, you start the car, it's going to start the car with the exhausts closed.
Yeah.
And then once you leave at 6:15, they fully open and then you can harass the people on the freeway. Then probably my favorite thing that they actually have driving modes now. So you have either, you know, button down on the dash or on the steering wheel, and you can scroll through normal driving mode. You have a customizable mode. Then you have racetrack, drag strip, and then, you know, snow and wet. So you can basically, with all these things, and it changes the digital dash that you have so that it actually goes back to like, it's like a throwback to the original Mustang dash that ran vertically across.
Yeah.
So it has all of this, and it's all digital. It's absolutely amazing.
That's awesome.
And then you get down to the drive. And what I said in the video was basically you need to respect this car because there's a reason why there are so many memes on the internet of this vehicle. A little bit too ambitious with the right-hand pedal and the back end steps out like that. Traction control or not.
I mean, that was the old V8 Mustang, right?
Exactly. And that is the biggest difference for me from the first one. The first one felt almost watered down.
Yeah.
Where this one seems to be a lot more lively, and you better know it. You better respect this vehicle.
Otherwise, you're in some trouble.
But probably the best thing that Ford has managed to do is to keep this vehicle at the same price that it was 5 years ago.
Wow.
915,800 rand, sub-1 million rand. But for what you're getting, there is very little that you can actually get to rival it. Toyota Supra, GR, the Porsche, not McLaren.
718.
The
Cayman.
Yes, the Cayman, sorry. I was going to say Boxster, but it's. So the Porsche Cayman, Supra GT, these are proper GT cars. And they're all in that 900,000 rand
mark. Category.
But where the Japanese Supra, which I absolutely adore, and the German, they just cannot do what this Mustang does. And that is when you push the start button and that engine revs, there's just nothing that can replace a V8.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm
an electric vehicle.
Exactly. I'm all for electric, but you know what? I think that is where ICE is going.
Yeah.
It is going to become that sense of occasion, that sense of, I have one of these, and there's only maybe, you know, 3,000 of these engines in the world, and I have one. And it's that sense of ceremony, the start and the rumble. And that's the thing about this Mustang. It doesn't matter where you are. People stop and stare.
Yeah. It's got some sort of aesthetic aura. Yes. Yeah.
And it's the V8. Because, you know, the V8, of course, is going to sell, far outsell the 2.3 EcoSnooze, yes, because it's the same car, but it just doesn't have.
It's not a Mustang.
But is it better than a BMW 440i Coupe?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, because I've driven that car and I can honestly tell you it's a bit of a small fest. And it is that when you're putting the two against each other, it is. What does
because
more for you?
We know that BMW drive right over it.
Yes, but it's boring. It's clinical.
Yeah, there's no theater.
There's no theater to it, and that's the appeal of the Mustang. It's the whole press the start button and listen to.
So, in short, it's still a car for posers.
All people who want to partake in crowd control.
I mean, Martin was setting you up there. It's a car for posers.
Either that or crowd control.
Well, thanks, Lawrence. It seems at least like it's a much better car than the pre-facelift one.
Absolutely.
Because 100%. I had a 2.3 EcoSnooze on test, and, well, it really bored the living daylights out of me.
And that's the thing about I thoroughly enjoyed the drive. You know, I said to myself, you know what, it's a V8, so I'm taking this week and I'm going to take next week's fuel allotment because that's when the car's 20 liters per 100 kilometers, you must know.
Well, if you buy a V8, you put the fuel is not a factor.
Yeah,
that's just one of those things. The fuel is not a factor. Anyway, so thanks, Lawrence. That was inspiring for the legacy of Ford Mustang, and it's visible on the searches on Autotrader because the Ford Mustangs were searched at 101,000 searches, where the BMW 4 Series came in second, not very far second, at 97,000 searches. BMW M2 at 57,000 searches, and the RS5 at 37,500 searches. So it looks like the Mustang is the most searched for car in this category anyway.
So if you want a little bit of entertainment, go onto Autotrader's website, go and look for the Mustang video review and have a watch. Lots of exciting engine
noises. Go and watch
noises.
The smile on Lawrence's face.
And then go, if here's the top of my head, it'd fall off.
Then go out and buy a BMW.
Okay, so, in talking about searches, we've had 4.7 million variant searches in the last 3 months, and Golf GTI made up 3% of total searches out of 16,000 variants on the site. VW also made up the top three most searched for variants, and Ford also had a spot in the top three, with the German giants BMW, Merck, and Audi rounding up the top four spots. So it looks like these cars are competing heavily with each other, and let's wait and see. Maybe the electric cars will start easing themselves up to the top of that list. Now we get into our Tech Talk segment, and the first piece of news in our Tech Talk segment is that the three-point seatbelt turns 60. Now, I didn't know the three-point seatbelt was even that old.
Yep, invented by Volvo and given to the world for Mahala.
Mm. Yep, exactly right. So this thing seems to be a bit of a hero because it was invented by Volvo, as you rightly point out, and has saved over a million lives since 1959. Mm. On August the 13th, 2019, it turned 60 and is still going strong, this three-point seatbelt.
I haven't seen anything else sort of creep in its place. As long as been in a car.
Well, the three-point seatbelt stops you from becoming a projectile. Because if you remember, it started out with lap belts. Mm. And with a lap belt, your head is still free to bob around the cabin in case of an accident, whereas with the three-point seatbelt. Yeah. But that's not the only feature that I found interesting about this three-point seatbelt.
Yeah.
Its design actually is there not only to, but also to help you clip the seatbelt in with one hand.
And unclip it with one hand as
well. And unclip it with one hand. Mm-hmm. Whereas any other Y seatbelt, harness, lap seatbelt,
it's a
two-handed procedure. Yeah. Whereas with this three-point seatbelt, you can actually do it with one hand. I mean, not that that should be necessary, but
I'm going to come clean here and say there are many times where I've driven out of my estate and with one hand on the seatbelt, I'm reaching over my shoulder to pull the seatbelt across while I'm still driving and clipping it in with one hand while I'm still trying to change gears. And
You try doing that with a 4 or 5 pointer.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
Not going to work.
So I think the world has done well to drive adoption of this three-point seatbelt since 1959.
And yet we still get absolute idiots who insist that it's safer without the seatbelt. Because
who says that?
I actually encounter these morons on a weekly basis.
You can actually go onto eBay and you can buy a seatbelt buckle that you plug into the clip next to you to stop the car from binging.
Who's selling this stuff?
It is on...
You can buy it on eBay. Yes. Or you can go to a scrapyard. No, I'm not going to give them...
No, don't give them ideas.
But these things exist because there are still people out there that
are morons who think that it's safer to be thrown out of a car than to be inside a car when it's in a collision.
How dumb.
Because now it catches a light and then I can't get the safety belt loose, which is something anyone can do with one hand.
Yes, so it's one-handed operation. The clip is mechanical. It's not electrical.
Exactly.
The chances of that seatbelt actually jamming, I mean, I don't know, but they would have, for me, I've had a look at the inside of a seatbelt clip. It is a very simple mechanism.
Yep.
It's not going to break very easily. Yep.
you know, the thing is, the original three-point seatbelt didn't have a retracting system. It was...
Yeah, it was loose. It was floppy.
It was floppy.
So the retracting system is actually designed to give a little bit of leeway before locking up completely in the event of an accident so that it doesn't snap your neck.
No, well, I mean, the later seatbelts actually pull you into the seat. They're pretension.
And so... From where we were 60 years ago with a three-point seatbelt, we now have the same three-point seatbelt, but the advancements and the technology that has gone into them has also gotten better as time has gone on. And I am an advocate for them. My children know, even in the back seat, get in the car before I even start reversing.
Yeah.
They've pulled the seatbelts and clipped them.
Well, I have a rule. If you are a passenger in my car, front or rear, I will not start the car unless you're buckled in. And if you don't want to buckle in, you get out.
Yeah, exactly right. So let's talk a little bit about why a multi-point seatbelt is important. So the first thing that I learned with seatbelts in general, with anything in general, it's about energy transfer. And the more points you can transfer that energy into, the better. So if you've got a lap seatbelt, you've got a energy that gets effectively only transferred into 2 points.
Your hips.
Your two hips. Mm. If you've got a 4-point seatbelt, that's probably the best, but not practical. You're transferring the energy to 4 points, whereas with the 3-point seatbelt, you're transferring the energy to 3 points. And the more we can spread that energy transfer, the more chance you are of your one part of your body not taking all of the energy transfer or all of the load.
Yeah, and that's why a 3-point belt is actually the best or the most practical compromise, because it spreads it. Okay, instead of spreading it over your shoulders, at least it spreads it over your rib cage.
Yes, spreads it over your rib cage from the bottom point where it clips into the seat post, and it spreads it across your body.
So the trick is to spread the impact forces or the deceleration forces over as much of as large an area as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all you have to do is, I think it's somewhere, I saw it floating around on social, it was a string of photos of people showing their bruises. These are people that are obviously 2 or 3 days post-accident, showing the bruises that the seatbelt gave them, and thanks for saving my life. And you can, it's not pretty.
Flip, it's going to hurt you. You can't expect to come out of an accident unscathed.
And I would rather have the bruises and my life than...
Instead of being a bouncing ball
around the bruises fade after a couple of weeks. But if you are basically a smashing pumpkin falling about inside the car, the pumpkin pips will be spread over the car's interior and smeared on the roadway. That's the option. That's the alternative.
And this is coming from a man who almost lost his life.
Yep.
Tell us more.
No, major car accident. A guy didn't check his blind spot, and a little Toyota would bounce off an Isuzu Bucky like a ping pong ball. This guy ran me off the road by not checking his blind spot.
Yeah, and you were wearing a seatbelt.
I was wearing a seatbelt, and because of that seatbelt, the car's safety cage could actually protect me because the safety belt kept me in the position where I was supposed to be for the car's cage to work.
Exactly. So these cars are tested. Their safety cage optimizes the occupants inside. So if you stay in that spot, you're in the best chance of surviving an accident. Whereas if you're bouncing around the car on the dashboard, off the back sill, or, it's not going to be pretty. So keep your frickin' seatbelt on.
Smashing pumpkin. There we go.
Exactly. So on that note, meet the SUV that can detect and monitor rocks as you drive over them. So Land Rover or Range Rover, to be more specific, has new tech in their cars, or is advancing the tech in their cars, and putting cameras underneath the car. So now we've got cameras in the rear, we've got cameras in the front, we've got cameras on the side, curb cameras, tow bar cameras, the only cameras that don't exist are selfie cameras, but now we've got cameras under the car.
And I can honestly tell you it works, because I have actually driven the new Range Rover Evoque that has this technology fitted. It is quite weird to drive, and then you see on the center console screen, it actually gives you like a superimposed view of the wheels and what you're driving over. Martin will be able to tell us more about it when he gets Evoque next week.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird, and this was one of the things that we tested when we did the launch 2 months ago.
Yeah.
We drove through a river and it's kind of weird to watch the camera submerge under the water, and you can actually see the rocks in the water as you're driving through it, and then out the other side. It gives you an idea of where your wheels are in relation to the terrain, and it really is for hardcore off-roaders.
Well, I mean, this also features now on the new Defender, which was launched last week.
They call it weight
control or weight recognition or something.
Yeah.
And if you can basically drive through water almost a meter deep, the thing has a wading depth of 900 millimeters, there's no way you're going to see a hidden obstacle under the water.
Yeah.
Unless you have a camera.
So they gave us a camera.
Well, this technology is its applications not only for rocks, but also it can see road markings,
pavements,
potholes. So it's not only for your serious off-roader, but the technology can have a look at what you're driving over in case of something.
Well, about a year and a half ago, Ford unveiled something that kind of ties into this technology. It monitors the road surface ahead for potholes. And when you are about to hit that pothole, it stiffens up the suspension, basically keeps the wheel suspended so it doesn't drop into the pothole.
So it glides over the pothole. Which this technology could be used to do.
Yeah.
So if you went to Lichtenberg, you would essentially have a flying car. Lichtenberg, but your roads are terrible.
I like that.
Anyway, so that's a piece of new tech, cameras underneath the car, and being able to glide over potholes. I like keeping on top of this particular principle, and that is flying cars or flying taxis. And the Volocopter has raised $55 million for flying taxis and wants it in the air within the next 3 years. So this week, travel startup Volocopter in Atlantis has unveiled the fact that they raised so far up to $93 million in funding, and the venture capital sector clearly isn't spooked by the talk of a recession in some markets, and they're going full steam ahead to try and develop this Volocopter. What do you think? Flying taxis, flying cars? Is that after electric?
Can't afford it. I'm sure this is probably for the super, super rich. But
Lilo Dallas Multipass. Martin knows what I'm talking about.
Multipass.
That's a private joke. We don't get it.
It's science fiction. A movie called The Fifth Element. They had flying taxis, and that's exactly what this is. I can't see it. Yeah. Maybe in 100 years. I just can't see in my lifetime. So I don't care.
I find this a lot more viable. Given technological constraints and the pace of change, than I find self-driving on the road taxis. Because if you start from scratch, I mean, you will not have so many helicopters basically picking up people on Park Lane as you would have self-driving taxis. So if you can integrate the computerized control and communication, which will make this possible from an early stage, I think it will actually be a game changer in the long term.
In the long term, But electric cars and technology will come first. And a recent study shows that consumers are warming up to in-car tech more than ever before. And it goes back to our first story, and that is the German car manufacturers and going up against the pure plays like Tesla. So automakers and marketers may want to pay more attention to this one, because since in-car technology, it seems to be appealing to potential car buyers. A vast majority, 81% in fact, of consumers see connected cars as a wave of the future and are looking forward to this future. Technology in new cars also will matter. The majority, again, 86% of consumers say technology and connectivity is important in their purchase of a new car. So,
as it is now, me personally, if a car does not have Apple CarPlay or Android Auto as a standard option, it's a deal breaker.
Well, here's this statistic. 18% of consumers say if their next car doesn't contain certain technologies, the likelihood of them buying it is low.
Well, if it does have Bluetooth, that's the bare minimum. I'm not interested.
So examples of, like Martin is saying, 72% say the connected a connection to their phone via Bluetooth is vital. Like, that's just no longer...
It's a must.
It's standard equipment nowadays. And of those, 79% will use it to play music and 75% to receive and make calls and 56% for GPS locations.
Well, so there you go. Android Auto, Apple CarPlay.
Mm-hmm. It's vital.
And anybody who drives on the freeway with their phone stuck to the side of their head and they are in a car that has Bluetooth...
I had one yesterday.
Oh, I hate those.
I will push you off the road. I don't care because...
Okay, don't take Lawrence
seriously. No, because
we can't really
you
say
have
that.
A vehicle that has these function. That every car has it. Even the cheapest car for sale in South Africa at the moment has Bluetooth connectivity. You have no excuse to have a phone to the side of your head.
Exactly. So now almost half of car owners use their smartphones to control the connected automobile and its devices. 79% are satisfied with the technology in their primary vehicle. So this seems to be like a thing of the future, the standard. You know, car manufacturers shouldn't be going out to make their own software. They should be partnering. And that's what Audi has done with Amazon to bring Alexa to... Now everybody's Alexas went off when I just said Alexa. To put Alexa's voice assistant inside the Audi, which I think is a smart move. And Apple CarPlay, I think it's a no-brainer now.
So you can say, Android. Hey Siri.
And yes.
A whole bunch of people's iPhones now.
Which actually happened, by the way. I will tell you the story after the fact. You're going to laugh and then you're going to phone Justin.
So cars are also getting more connected, and 68% of consumers say their car provides a direct internet connection without using their smartphone. This is important to them. However, 65% say that they have never used a Wi-Fi connected device in their car using Wi-Fi supplied by the vehicle. So whether Wi-Fi in a vehicle is important or not, I don't know. But then that leads us to our next story, and that Toyota unveils the My Toyota app. Now, the My Toyota apps, one of the biggest draw cards of the My Toyota app is internet connectivity in the car, and turns the Toyota into a mobile Wi-Fi hotspot and includes 15 gigabytes of free data as a once-off purchase. Now, you know, is Wi-Fi important in a car? I think connection to the internet's important because it needs to be connected to other cars and other things in the future and traffic lights
and navigation.
Navigation and all that stuff. But I'm not so sure that it's important to be as a hotspot.
So you have a Toyota Quantum. Mm. You are authorized to carry 16 passengers. Mm. Your morning commute into work in the taxi, you have Wi-Fi.
That's yes, for that purpose.
That is, that
I absolutely
is
agree.
Where, that is now where I see where
there's a Toyota opportunity there.
Lasered in on that.
Yeah.
I can't really see
not
why.
Not for the average general consumer that's driving around.
I've actually read some overseas car reviews over the last couple of weeks where they stated that they actually use this on long trips to keep the kids in the back seat occupied.
The Disco 5.
Yeah, but
actually,
it's an edge case, eh?
Yeah. The Disco 5 has a 50 gig onboard hard drive where you can store movies and series and stuff, and then you can watch them through the screens on the back seat.
That's but let's be honest. Our tablets and our phones all have 4G and eventually 5G. So I'm not sure the Wi-Fi hotspot, except for those edge cases, is the primary use case is a Wi-Fi hotspot.
True. I've never used one in a car.
Where this is going to be important is going to be with connected things.
Yeah.
Traffic lights, other cars.
Targeted apps, ads. Targeted car ads.
There goes my role.
No, you'll be driving on the N1, sitting in traffic. You'll drive past a billboard. The car will see an advert for Mentos gum. It'll realize, hey, you've been chewing Mentos gum. You might want to be hearing about this, and we'll play a targeted ad through your radio. Wonderful.
Well, then, in that case, that gets us to our grid talk. And in the last race, Leclerc won.
He did,
and he
finally
took the race from Lewis Hamilton. Tell us about that one, Dile.
So usually I'm actually not excited about Monza, but this had to be one of the most exciting races for the season for me. I saw an upcoming future great battle of probably the top driver of the last 10 years, and he was trying his hardest, and he was forced into mistakes. I thought that was incredible for the rookie to come in and really show not just Ferrari fans, but motorsport fans that nothing is forever. And there's new people who have the craziest skill and and who want to stamp their name in the history books. So for me, it was an amazing race. When Hamilton failed, then Bottas would come, and still the same thing. They couldn't stop him.
They just couldn't stop him. He was formidable, and I think personally that Leclerc is the next, not necessarily this year's, but at some point in the next two or three years is going to be the next world champion.
I agree.
And then there's talk that Lewis Hamilton may actually move to Ferrari.
Pie in the sky, never going to happen.
Huh?
You never know. This happens quite frequently. If you look at history.
What? That Hamilton moves to Ferrari?
No, that people. Finished at their old teams and moved to Ferrari. Ferrari is like the home of
it's
race.
Like the posturing ground for old Grand Prix drivers. So. Mm.
The Who posturing knows? Ground for old Grand Prix drivers. Are you talking about Alonso?
Yes,
it's
the place where Grand Prix drivers go.
I mean, I've lost
kind of like the retirement village of Grand Prix teams.
I've lost my faith in Alonso because he came to South Africa and hit a guinea fowl.
And what about Vettel? I mean, he's there now. Is he about to retire?
You know what? I think Vettel has passed his sell-by date, unless he has a mindset shift. I don't know.
Let's not give up on him.
No, let's not give up on him. I mean, he's still in the Ferrari team, so let's not give up on him. But I think Leclerc is taking it to the next level, to be honest.
No, definitely.
And then, another piece of interesting news is Michael Schumacher is apparently awake.
Apparently, I think that's the biggest word.
The story was that they took him to Paris. He had some experimental surgery, and now he's awake. Whether he's actually compos mentis is, we don't know.
Yeah. Well, reportedly conscious and being visited by Formula One colleagues following treatment in Paris, and apparently he had some kind of stem cell therapy that has caused this. To happen or caused him to wake up. And 50-year-old German motor racing legend was spotted recuperating with Jean Todt, the Scuderia Ferrari team boss who recruited the 7-time world champion. You know, what I'd love to see here, honestly, is I'd love to see him make a full recovery and have some sort of role to play in that Ferrari team. Yeah. Because if anything, I think he will bring the leadership that may be needed in that team.
That just scares me. The thought of that terrifies me.
I'll take a different angle.
Of Michael coming to Ferrari, because that would be the end of...
Okay, well, I was like waiting for this big moment, but flipping, I'll take that one.
Where old Grand Prix drivers go. No, actually, my take is a bit different. If this is actually true, and if it's successful, and this Paris surgery and stem cell therapy did actually do the trick, hopefully Michael Schumacher could become a spokesperson to gain greater public acceptance of stem cell therapy and get more research funds channeled into that.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I think you're absolutely spot on, right? 100%. But his passion, who knows? Maybe when he's woken up from his, remember this happened in December 2013.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when you wake up after 5 years, some things might have changed in his mind.
Yeah.
So that's actually what I hope would happen.
Well, on that note, I think it's all good because Schumacher, I don't think deserves to have gone in a way that he did, in a skiing accident, and that unfortunately brings us to the end of our show. So I hope you all have a fantastic week. Thank you very much, Martin. Thank you, Lawrence. Thank you, Wandile. And see you in 2 weeks'
time.
Thank
you, gents. It's been a great show.
It has. Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.